بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the Most Merciful, the Most Compassionate.
يا أيها النبي اتق الله ولا تطع الكافرين والمنافقين إن الله كان عليما حكيما.
O Prophet, fear Allah and do not obey the unbelievers and the hypocrites. Verily, Allah is all-knowing, most wise. O Prophet, as we have pointed out in our introduction to this surah, these verses were revealed after Zayd had divorced Zainab. The Prophet, peace be upon him, himself felt the need to strike a severe blow at the jahili practice of adoption and the superstitious notions associated with it. God had also hinted to him that the time had come to do away with that institution and that he should go ahead and marry Zainab, the divorced wife of his adopted son, Zayd. This would prove to be the final step in eradicating this institution. The Prophet, peace be upon him, however, was reluctant. The unbelievers and hypocrites were already filled with rage and rancor against him because of a succession of accomplishments. He therefore felt that his marrying Zainab might provide them with a scandalous pretext, one which they could use to discredit him. This, in turn, would damage the cause of Islam. The Prophet, peace be upon him, was not so much worried about his personal reputation, but rather more concerned about the harm this might do to Islam's cause. He was worried lest the ensuing storm of malicious propaganda might have a negative influence on those who were favorably inclined towards Islam. Furthermore, those whose attitude towards Islam was one of neutrality might also become hostile to Islam. At the same time, the Muslims, who had not by then acquired full intellectual maturity, might begin to entertain doubts about their faith. In view of all this, the Prophet, peace be upon him, felt that it was not expedient to marry Zainab, for this might adversely affect the larger interests of Islam.
Fear Allah and do not obey the unbelievers and the hypocrites. Verily, Allah is all-knowing, most wise.
At the very outset, God removes the Prophet's concerns mentioned above. The purport of what is being said here is to stress that God knows best wherein lie the interests of the faith He had ordained. Likewise, He knows best when certain steps should be taken and others avoided. The Prophet, peace be upon him, should, therefore, not act in any manner that would conform with the wishes of the unbelievers and hypocrites. Rather, he should do what God directs him to do. It is God, not the unbelievers and hypocrites, who ought to be held in awe.
واتبع ما يوحى إليك من ربك إن الله كان بما تعملون خبيرا.
Follow that which is revealed to you from your Lord. Verily, Allah is fully aware of all that you do.
Verily, Allah is fully aware of all that you do.
This verse is addressed to the Prophet, peace be upon him, to his companions, as well as to Islam's detractors. The fact that the Prophet, peace be upon him, is patiently enduring his enemies' assaults on his personal integrity is not hidden from him. Likewise, God is fully informed about the Muslims who are steadfast in their loyalty and devotion to the Prophet, peace be upon him, as well as those who succumb to doubts and suspicions about him. As for the unbelievers and hypocrites, they are told that God is perfectly cognizant of their vicious efforts to malign the Prophet, peace be upon him. Indeed, all will be rewarded or punished in accordance with their conduct.
وَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى اللَّهِ وَكَفَى بِاللَّهِ وَكِيلًا.
Put your trust in Allah. Allah is sufficient as guardian.
Put your trust in Allah. Allah is sufficient as guardian.
This again is addressed to the Prophet, peace be upon him, who is directed to discharge the duty entrusted to him and to place his full trust in God. He is also asked not to be intimidated, even if all mankind are arrayed against him. Once a person knows for sure that a certain command is from God, he should feel convinced that Islam's best interests will be served by carrying out that command.
Once that is clear, it should no longer be his concern to decide about the dictates of wisdom and public interest. Rather, he should fully trust God and follow his command. Such is God that one should entrust all one's affairs to him, because he is sufficient both to guide man as well as to come to his aid. It is also reassuring that God guarantees that anyone who acts as directed by him will not face misfortune.
مَا جَعَلَ اللَّهُ لِرَجُلٍ مِّن قَلْبَيْنِ فِي جَوْفِهِ وَمَا جَعَلَ أَزْوَاجَكُمُ اللَّائِي تُظَاهِرُونَ مِنْهُنَّ أُمَّهَاتِكُمْ وَمَا جَعَلَ أَدْعِيَاءَكُمْ أَبْنَاءَكُمْ ذَلِكُمْ قَوْلُكُمْ بِأَفْوَاهِكُمْ وَاللَّهُ يَقُولُ الْحَقَّ وَهُوَ يَهْدِي السَّبِيلِ
Allah has never put two hearts within one person's body, nor has He made your wives, whom you compare to your mother's backs, to divorce them. Your true mothers, nor has He made those whom you adopt as sons your own sons. These are only words that you utter with your mouths. But Allah proclaims the truth and directs you to the right path. Allah has never put two hearts within one person's body. That is, a person cannot be a true believer and a hypocrite, truthful and liar, virtuous and wicked at one and the same time. Obviously, no one has been endowed with two hearts, one filled with faithful devotion and the other bereft of God-fearingness. One can either be a true believer or a hypocrite, be a Muslim or an unbeliever. To call a Muslim a hypocrite or a hypocrite a Muslim does not change the reality. A person will either be one or the other. Nor has He made your wives, whom you compare to your mother's backs, to divorce them. Your true mothers. Zihar was a technical term commonly used by the Arabs. In the time of Jahiliyyah, a husband would tell his wife in a fit of anger that her back for him was like the back of his own mother. This signified that his wife would henceforth be forbidden to him. God makes it clear that a man's simple utterance about a woman being like his mother does not change his wife into his mother. The man's mother can only be the woman who gave birth to him. In other words, calling one's wife one's mother does not make any difference as regards the real status of the relationship. It should be noted that the purpose of this verse is not to prescribe detailed laws in regard to zihar. Those laws are laid down in Surah Al-Mujaddala 58:2-4. Nor has He made those whom you adopt as sons your own sons. This is the main purpose of the verse. The two things said above are by way of argument to stress that a person does not truly become another person's son merely by his calling him so.
ادعوهم لآبائهم هو أقسط عند الله فإن لم تعلموا آباءهم فإخوانكم في الدين ومواليكم وليس عليكم جناح فيما أخطأتم به ولكن ما تعمدت قلوبكم وكان الله غفورا رحيما
Call your adopted sons after their true fathers. That is more equitable in the sight of Allah. But if you do not know their true fathers, then regard them as your brethren in faith and as allies. You will not be taken to task for your mistaken utterances, but you will be taken to task for what you say deliberately. Allah is most forgiving, most compassionate. Call your adopted sons after their true fathers. That is more equitable in the sight of Allah. The first impact of this injunction was that Zaid was no longer called Zaid ibn Muhammad, but rather as Zaid ibn Haritha. In light of this verse, it was forbidden for anyone to ascribe his paternity to anyone other than his father. Bukhari, Muslim, and Abu Dawud narrated the Prophet's following saying, as reported by Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas. Whoever knowingly calls someone his father, other than his own father, will be forbidden from entering paradise. There are other traditions as well that embody the same principle and declare this act to be a major sin. But if you do not know their true fathers, then regard them as your brethren in faith and as allies. This forbids false ascription of lineage. You will not be taken to task for your mistaken utterances, but you will be taken to task for what you say deliberately. There is no harm if someone calls another person his son by way of endearment. Likewise, there is no harm if a person were to affectionately call someone his mother or father, brother or sister. However, it is quite objectionable if he were to say this in the sense that the person concerned has indeed become his mother or father, son or daughter, and that they enjoy the same rights as laid down for blood relatives. Allah is most forgiving, most compassionate. One meaning of this is that God has forgiven all their past lapses in this regard, and they will not be taken to task for those lapses. The second meaning is that God does not punish people for acts they did not deliberately commit.
النبي أولى بالمؤمنين من أنفسهم وأزواجه أمهاتهم وأولو الأرحام بعضهم أولى ببعض في كتاب الله من المؤمنين والمهاجرين إلا أن تفعلوا إلى أوليائكم معروفا كان ذلك في الكتاب مسطورا.
Surely, the Prophet has a greater claim over the believers than they have over each other, and his wives are their mothers. According to the Book of Allah, blood relatives have greater claim over each other than the rest of the believers, and the emigrants in the cause of Allah, except that you may do some good to your allies if you so wish. This is inscribed in the Book of Allah. Surely, the Prophet has a greater claim over the believers than they have over each other. Muslims' relationship with the Prophet, peace be upon him, stands on a higher pedestal than all other relationships. In fact, no relationship bears any comparison with a Muslim's relationship with the Prophet, peace be upon him. For his part, the Prophet, peace be upon him, is more tender and compassionate towards Muslims than even their own parents. The same is true for his deep, passionate concern for their well-being. It is possible that a person's parents or his own children might harm him, act selfishly towards him, mislead him, or prompt him to commit misdeeds that would push him towards hell. None of this, however, is conceivable with regard to the Prophet, peace be upon him, for he can do only that which is most conducive to every person's best interests. Even though someone might decide to go along the path of self-destruction, the Prophet's advice and guidance will always be that which is most beneficial to him. In view of this, Muslims are obliged to cherish the Prophet, peace be upon him, more than everyone else, including themselves, their parents, and their children. They should love him more than anything and anyone in the world, and give preference to the Prophet's opinions and judgments rather than to their own. This idea is clearly expressed in the following hadith. None of you can be a true believer unless you hold me dearer than your parents, children, and all others. There is some slight variation in the wording of the hadith in these two works.
And his wives are their mothers.
While the believers may marry their mothers by adoption, it is forbidden for them to marry the Prophet's wives, for they are mothers for all believers. Marrying them is forbidden to Muslims in the same way as marrying their own mothers. This was laid down exclusively for the Prophet, peace be upon him, and is applicable to no one else. It is noteworthy that the Prophet's wives are known as the mothers of the believers, in the sense that it is obligatory for Muslims to hold them in very high esteem. Hence, they may not marry them. In all other respects, however, they are not their mothers. For instance, all Muslims, except those who are their kin, will not be reckoned as their mahrim, those with whom marriage is forbidden, and they will be required to observe hijab with them.
Likewise, the daughters of the Prophet's daughters are not the foster sisters of all Muslims, and hence it is not forbidden to marry them, nor is it forbidden for Muslims to marry the brothers and sisters of the Prophet's wives on the grounds that they are aunts and uncles. The same applies to shares in their inheritance, which should not go to any Muslim not related to the Prophet's wives by ties of kinship. It should be noted that this exalted status of the Prophet's wives is a privilege enjoyed by all his wives, including, of course, Aisha. This point is significant because a section of people place only Ali, Fatima, and their children at the center stage of Islam. These people try to discredit Aisha along with numerous other companions, hurling all sorts of accusations at them. However, they will not be able to make much headway in their maligning campaign, for they will be confronted with this Quranic verse, which asks everyone who lays claim to being a believer to recognize the Prophet's wives as his mothers. To wriggle out of this difficult situation, these people make the bizarre claim that the Prophet, peace be upon him, authorized Ali to divorce any of his wives after his demise and to let those whom he, that is Ali, liked continue to be his wives. Abu Mansur Ahmed ibn Abi Talib al-Tabrasi makes this outrageous claim in his Kitab al-Ihtijaj, which has been reproduced as follows by Suleiman ibn Abdullah al-Bahrani. The Prophet, peace be upon him, told Ali, "O Abu al-Hasan, this privilege remains as long as we remain obedient to God. So if any of my wives rises in revolt against you and disobeys God, divorce her and deprive her of the privilege of being mother of the believers." This report is obviously devoid of any substance according to the accepted canons of hadith transmission. Furthermore, in the light of verses 28 to 29 and 51 to 52 of this surah, it even conflicts with the Quran itself. The fact that the Prophet, peace be upon him, forfeited the right to divorce any of his wives who had opted for his company is evident from verse 29 of the surah. This point is further elaborated in notes 42 and 93 below. Were one to objectively study the above-mentioned report, one is bound not only to dismiss it as absurd, but also as a sheer fabrication, one that is insulting to the Prophet, peace be upon him. This because it depicts him in a very poor light. Not even an ordinary decent person, let alone a messenger of God, can be expected to consider divorcing his wives after his death, or of authorizing his son-in-law to divorce them on his behalf if they subsequently have any dispute with him. This lays bare the falsity of such people's claims to have overflowing love and reverence for the Prophet's family and the Prophet, peace be upon him, himself. In fact, it also shows the scant respect they have for God's commands. According to the Book of Allah, blood relatives have greater claim over each other than the rest of the believers and the emigrants in the cause of Allah, except that you may do some good to your allies. This verse elucidates that with the exception of the Prophet, peace be upon him, who holds a unique position in the eyes of Muslims, the mutual relations among Muslims will be based on the principle that one's kith and kin receive priority over all other Muslims in matters such as charity, zakah, and inheritance. It is improper to neglect one's own parents, wives, and children, and one's brothers and sisters, and give charity to others. As regards zakah, one should first give it to the deserving amongst one's next of kin and then to other needy people. The same principle applies to inheritance. The property left behind by a deceased person is inherited by his closely related kin. A Muslim may help others with gifts by making waqf in their favor or by specifying something for them in his will. One's heirs, however, cannot be denied their due share of inheritance in order to provide benefit to others. In effect, this verse puts an end to that special nexus of brotherhood that had been established between the Muhajirun and the Ansar after the Prophet's migration to Medina. Before the promulgation of this rule, those Muhajirun and Ansar who had been bound in this tie of brotherhood inherited each other. God, however, replaced this by promulgating the laws of inheritance, which only take into account blood ties. One may nonetheless, if one so wants, give any of one's brethren in faith whatever one likes as a gift or by means of bequest.
وَإِذْ أَخَذْنَا مِنَ النَّبِيِّينَ مِيثَاقَهُمْ وَمِنْكَ وَمِنْ نُوحٍ وَإِبْرَاهِيمَ وَمُوسَى وَعِيسَى بْنِ مَرْيَمَ وَأَخَذْنَا مِنْهُمْ مِيثَاقًا غَلِيظًا.
And call to mind, O Prophet, when we took the covenant from all prophets, and also from you, and Noah, and Abraham, Moses, and Jesus, the son of Mary, peace be upon them. We took from them a solemn covenant.
God reminds the Prophet, peace be upon him, that like other messengers, he had entered into a covenant with God that he must faithfully honor. As to the exact nature of the covenant, it appears from the context that it refers to the messenger's commitment to obey God's every command and to make others do the same. A messenger is also charged with the duty to faithfully transmit whatever comes to him from God and to exert his efforts in order that God's commands are put into effect. At other places too, the Quran speaks of this covenant. He has prescribed for you the religion which he enjoined upon Noah, peace be upon him, and which we reveal to you, O Muhammad, peace be upon him, and which we enjoined on Abraham, Moses, and Jesus, peace be upon them, commanding, establish this religion and do not split up regarding it. Al-Shura 42:13. Recall when God took a covenant from those who were given the book. You shall explain it to people and not hide it. Al-Imran 3:187. And recall, when we made a covenant with the children of Israel, you shall serve none but God. Al-Baqarah 2:83. Was not the covenant of the book taken from them? Hold firmly to that which we have given you, and remember what is in it, that you may guard against evil. Al-Araf 7:169 and 171. Remember Allah's favor upon you and His covenant which He made with you when you said, we have heard and we obey. Al-Maidah 5:7. What prompts the mention of this covenant in the present context is that the Prophet, peace be upon him, was initially somewhat reluctant to put an end to the pre-Islamic custom of adoption because he apprehended severe opposition from Islam's enemies. He felt specifically bashful about marrying Zainab because Islam's enemies would misconstrue this marriage as one motivated by sensuality. Further, that they would do so in disregard of the Prophet's utter sincerity in his bid to bring about social reform. He also perceived that his opponents would discredit him as one who wore the cloak of reform, though his real concerns were those of the flesh. Accordingly, God reminds the Prophet, peace be upon him, that like his other messengers, he too is required to carry out God's commands and to ask others to do the same. He should therefore disregard the taunts and derisions of his opponents. He should neither be afraid nor feel shy in the face of his detractors, but should rather concentrate on performing the duty assigned to him by God. Some people construe this to refer to the covenant which was made with earlier prophets and their respective communities, obliging them to believe in and support those prophets who would come later. Al-Imran 3:81. In the light of this interpretation, these people subscribe to the notion that even after the Prophet Muhammad's advent, peace be upon him, another prophet is possible. In other words, they think that since such a covenant was made with the Prophet, peace be upon him, his community is bound to follow the Prophet who comes after him. It is quite clear from the context of the present verse, however, that this is an altogether flawed interpretation. The context does not admit any possibility for the advent of any Prophet after Muhammad, peace be upon him. Nor is the Prophet's community bound to believe in the prophethood of any such claimant. The content of the verse also reveals that were this interpretation to be accepted, the verse would look altogether odd and incongruous. Besides, its wording also has no suggestion to this effect. In order to ascertain the nature and meaning of the covenant, the only thing we can do is to refer to those Quranic verses that speak of covenants with prophets. Had the Quran mentioned only a single covenant, and that too about the requirement to believe in those prophets who will appear later, some allowance could have been made for the above interpretation. However, anyone conversant with the Quran recognizes that it refers to a number of covenants that were variously made with prophets and their communities. Therefore, the meaning of the word covenant in this verse is determined in keeping with its context rather than arbitrarily. Such false and tendentious interpretations betray the fact that some people do not turn to the Quran for guidance, but instead arbitrarily read their own ideas into it.
لِيَسْأَلَ الصَّادِقِينَ عَنْ صِدْقِهِمْ وَأَعَدَّ لِلْكَافِرِينَ عَذَابًا أَلِيمًا
So that their Lord may question the truthful about their truthfulness. As for the unbelievers, He has kept a painful chastisement in store for them.
So that their Lord may question the truthful about their truthfulness.
That is, God did not simply make a covenant, but will also call the people concerned to account and see how true they were to their covenant. Those who fulfilled the requisites of the covenant will be reckoned as God's true servants.
As for the unbelievers, He has kept a painful chastisement in store for them.
For a better appreciation of these verses, one should study them in conjunction with verses 36 to 41 of this surah.